Okay, so we are holding on Mem Zion Amud Bey's fourth line.
Okay, we learned yesterday
that we have a choice.
When our Mishnah says that according to the rate, mayor,
but anyway, so the way we had it printed in our Gemara is that Rabbi Yossi is the one that says Chazra Shavuah L'Makayma.
That both parties in the Din Parah are both subsected to waiting for. So Shavuah returns to his place.
What does that mean? So we said that Rav and Shmuel understood that to mean it returns to Sinai, meaning, in other words, therefore we leave everything as it is monetarily, and we leave it up to Hashem to the Eivishter to set things right. Then we had Rabbi Sein Shabbat Yisrael, namely Rav Abba, saying that it means the Shavuah returns to where it was supposed to be in the first place, where it would have been under normal circumstances. Meaning the person who would ordinarily the nitva, the defendant, who normally would swear and be potter, and like this, since he can't swear, then he ends up paying. The last thing in that connection was a brisa that when it says when the pasuk says shavuah Hashem tia ben shneim, that the shavuah of Hashem is between the two of them, meaning it has to be between the two original parties, not between the yorshim. And we discussed so how would that fit according to Rav and Shmuel.
The parties themselves are going to be possible if no Shavuah can be taken, if a special
Chazar Shavuah to Sinai, and nothing happens in Beis Din. So why would the Braita need to be telling us that the Yoshim are potter if the principals themselves are potter? So therefore, so that Braita seems to fit, that Braita fits better with Rabba's opinion. So now the question becomes, Rav Abba Shmuel,
why is it saying that the Yoshim are potter?
If, according to Rav Abba, you're saying that the person who should have had to swear becomes chayav to pay, so therefore the Pasuk would be telling us by saying, Shavuah Hashem Tia Ben Shneim, that if you're not talking about the original Nitzbah himself, the original defendant himself, but rather you're talking about his children, then they are potter from having to pay for their in a case where their father wasn't able to swear. It wasn't the case. We didn't mention the case Koshet al Shavuah. We mentioned a different case. We can't swear because of the Tainus Shema, because he himself is not certain.
Okay, the point still remains that.
So the Pasuk would be saying he himself would have been chayav to pay because he can't swear. However, his children are potter. But according to Rav and Shmuel, he himself is potter because Chazar Shmuel is Sinai. So why do we need a brisa to be explaining a Pasuk to tell us that the Yoshim are potter? Of course, if he's potter, of course, how much more so the Yoshim are potter? So the question is, Rav Shmuel, Hai Shavuos Hashem, Mai Kodarshi Bein. So what do Rav Shmuel do with this Pasuk, Shavuos Hashem, Tia Bein Shneim?
The answer is, you've already learned the time, yeah? They use it to teach us what it says in the following line, the Shimon the Tire.
We learned this before, when it says, Shavuos Hashem, Tia Bein Shneim, Malamet Shah Shavuah, Cholal Shneim, this comes to teach us that the Shavuah and the punishment for it falls on both of them, which we discussed. We had this back on Daf Lamed Tes. We discussed a few possibilities that we're showing him explain what that means. It means that it doesn't necessarily mean both of them. It means either one or the other, because either it was a false Shavuah and then the one who swore falsely is responsible, or it was a true Shavuah and then the other one is held responsible for having brought about the situation, then he has to swear. Or we said over there that even if it does end up being a false Shavuah, not only the one who swore falsely, but also the other one is responsible if he did business with him in the first place, or that he doesn't, or what the Rimi Gash said over there, that's it. Yeah, we had the explanation over there of the Rimi Gash that once, for example, Reuven sees that Shimon is about to swear, and he knows that what Shimon is going to swear is false because Reuven himself knows perfectly well the debt has not in fact been paid off. Then he should back off and say, you know what, I don't want Shimon to have to end up swearing falsely. Fine, I withdraw my claim and I'll leave it up to Hashem to deal with it. So therefore, if he allows the Shavuah to go through, knowing that Shimon is swearing falsely, then he himself deserves a share of the blame. So those are a number of different.
If that's the case, why do we say Benehem if Hashem is involved?
What do you mean? Hashem is involved because it's every avera involves Hashem, but no. It's Benehem in the sense that it falls on both of them. Benehem. So again, either it means it falls on one of the two of them, or it means that the blame for the false Shavuah, of course, falls primarily on the one who swore falsely, but a certain degree of blame also attaches to the other one, either for having gotten himself into the situation in the first place, so you have three different explanations, basically, what it means, Shavuah Chol Al-Shneim. Three different explanations. The one is that it doesn't mean both of them. It means either one or the other, depending whether it ended up being a true or false Shavuah.
This
Shimon more truthfully than the blame attaches
to Reuven, that he brought about the situation that a shvuah had to be made. If Shimon swears falsely, then the blame is on Shimon. That's one way of explaining it. A second way of explaining it is, it means it's either one or the other. It means it's al shneim. It means that you should know. It's not just one of them. It's one or the other. It's not just always one of them. It's one or the other. Again, that's one.
There's one that forces the shvuah, even though the shvuah is an honest shvuah.
That's fine, but nevertheless, the point is, still, even a true shvuah is a very serious thing, as we've learned before.
So anyway,
that's one explanation. A second explanation is, if it was a false shvuah, then the punishment falls on both of them,
right.
One for swearing falsely, and the other one, for example, for having lent him money, for having lent him money or whatever, knowing that he's not... Yeah, obviously if he knew that this person is not trustworthy. And the third explanation, which is the Rimi Gash, is that we're talking about now when he sees this guy is about to swear falsely, he should back off and say, and then not
proceed. And if he doesn't,
then the fault is on both.
The only one that gives me a little problem is the first one.
Okay.
Because the first one
is, you make him swear, that's fine, but even if he makes him swear honestly, still
a degree of blame, because what are you putting it in a situation where there has to be a shvur in the first place?
Fine, he wants to get his money.
Fine, but okay. The fact that you caused somebody else to have to take a shvur is a very serious thing. Okay. Fine. Since we mentioned the statement of Shimon ben Tyfon, so the Gemara mentions a couple of other statements of his. Shimon ben Tyfon is a Tana. I don't think we have him any place else in Shas. So therefore, we have him in Midrashim or whatever, but not. So therefore, the Gemara puts in a couple of other things that he said as well. Not directly related to this. I don't know actually why it is. I mean, we quoted the statement of his before on Daf Lamed Tes. I don't know why the Gemara didn't bring these things in over there, why it waited till here, but okay. Anyway. Also, Shimon ben Tyfon, Azhara lo'okev acha noyef minayim. Where do we know? We know the Torah says you're not allowed to commit adultery. Where do we know, though, that a person who makes it possible for somebody else to do that, Rashi says, for example, he becomes an apotropos for him, he makes available for him women being adultery. I mean, in general, relations that are, I mean, yeah, in general, nus relations. So a procurer, basically. How do we know that such a thing is also? Tamad loyma loysinach, therefore, because when the pasuk says loysinach, which means don't commit adultery, we can also read it as loysanif, do not make it possible for adultery to be committed.
Because
it's written in this way, loysinach, rather than it could have said like it says elsewhere in the Torah, el eishes amischa loytitin shchavsecha, don't lie with your friend's wife. It could have ervas eishes reacha loytigala, or whatever the common kind of expression. The fact that it expresses it in this way, loysanif. The fact that it says loisinach rather makes it possible to understand it also as loisani.
Marshall brings out a couple of other explanations. It means literally means that he follows on his footsteps.
He makes it available for him. Also, like it means like he tricks people into getting involved in it. The fact that it says loisinach allows us to also understand it as meaning not only as an active verb, but also like as a transitive verb, that don't make somebody else come in here. An interesting thing also, the Chassam Sofer says
another explanation on it also. It means when you say oisav
hanoyah, for example, a person who is so suspicious of his wife that he's always that he's always following in her footsteps to see exactly where she goes, and that itself is more likely to make her try to do something that she shouldn't do. The very fact that, so therefore he says that's the connection with the previous thing. The same way as we said the previous thing about the shavua is you caused somebody else to do a shvuah shav, therefore you bear a certain degree of responsibility. The same way over here, a husband who does that to his wife bears a certain degree of responsibility when she goes and then does that. Okay. Another one from Shimon ben Tyfon. The pasuk says, by the Moshe describes in Parshas Bamidbar, when he's repeating over the story of the Meraglim, he says that when the Meraglim came back with their report, vateirognu ba'aleichem, you vateirognu in your tent. So the simple meaning of vateirognu is you became argumentative, Rashi brings over there on the topic that the Shorosh Reish Gimel Nun means to be argumentative, but the Shivan Matar for Reish Gimel Nun, that's the Shorosh, right? The Pasuk, for example, and the Pasuk in Mishlei, for example, Divrei Nirgun, the words of an argumentative person, yeah. But Shimon ben Taifer, it also means Tautim beginisim ba'ale shamakim. Look at this. You went and spied out the land, and then you spoke in a derogatory way about Hashem who made His Shechina rest among you. So Tautim, you spied out the land beginisim, and then you spoke in a derogatory way ba'ale shamakim about Hashem who put His tent among you.
What are we referring to?
We're referring to the fact that they spoke Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael, and not just about Eretz Yisrael, that they spoke badly about Hashem, saying that Hashem hates us, and they don't want to take us into Eretz Yisrael. When the Menachem came back with their report. Yeah. Another explanation also is all Lashon Hara means Eretz Yisrael, that he spoke derogatorily about Eretz Yisrael. Another one, the Pasuk says, in a couple of places, the Torah describes, Adam Noha had God on the Har Pros. You know, in a few places when the Torah describe the borders of Eretz Yisrael, it says up all the way to the big river, the river Pros. Now, why is it the big river? It's not necessarily bigger than other rivers. In fact, it is big compared to a lot of rivers in the world. But for example, we look at the list of the four rivers that came out of Aden to water the Gan. There were no Yosef and Aden, Lashkas, and Gan, and then it divided into four that we have in Parashas Bereishis. The Pros is listed as the fourth one. They're implying that's smaller than the other one. So why are we calling it Hanover and Gadol?
All the rivers in the world,
but among those four, though, so why don't we? Why are we saying Hanoha Gadol Nahar Pros, as if to imply it's the biggest of all rivers, when the Pishon and the Gihon and the Chidekel are bigger than it? Yeah.
So the Shimon is greater.
Well, I don't know. I've never measured it. But the Chidekel was listed before the Pros, and we should have to assume so. Well, Shimon ben Taifa, in and of itself, it's not really that big, but because it's the border of Eretz Yisrael, as the expression goes, "Krav l'gabi gehina," you come close to a person who's anointed with oil, the idhan, and you will become anointed as well. Meaning, in other words, that the Pros may be smaller than the other three rivers that are listed over there, but because it's adjacent to Eretz Yisrael, it's the border of Eretz, one of the borders of Eretz Yisrael. What do you think it means when you say in the Torah all over the place, "Adhan nahar gabal nahar Pros"? Okay, you have to distinguish between, first of all, the ideal borders of Eretz Yisrael, and then there's the actual borders that they conquered, or the Mitzrayim, or the Babel. Of course, the Babel certainly didn't resettle that far. Even the Mitzrayim, it's not necessarily, maybe in the times of David and Shlomo they reached that far, but not necessarily before that. I mean, you have different opinions
together. From the Mediterranean to Napa?
Well, there may well have been. It's all part of the Fertile Crescent, and there may well have been at one time. There may have been continuous Jewish settlement from one to the other. Whatever it is, the point is, it is the ideal borders of Eretz Yisrael, as described in the Torah, go all the way to the Har Pros. And even that, by the way, I mean, you have, so in Parshas Maaseh, when it lists the specific borders, city by city, you have a city mentioned over there, Chatzar Einon, which maybe doesn't say so in the Pasuk, but maybe it's near the Pros. So it could be. Anyway, the point is, because it's adjacent to Eretz Yisrael, which is important, therefore this river is also considered the great river. Not necessarily as far as practical halacha, because again, yeah, maybe it's part of the borders of Eretz Mitzrayim, certainly not part of the borders of Eretz Babel. And generally speaking, when we talk about the beginning of the mitzvahs that flow as far as of mitzvahs that apply only in Eretz Yisrael, usually those apply only in the territories of Eretz Babel. So no, but nevertheless, in the original borders, right, it's all across, was one of the borders. Devei Rabbi Shmuel Tana, in the Yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, they learned a different way of expressing this idea. Eved Melech Kemelech, the servant of a king, is like the king himself. Again, a similar idea, that because the river is next to Eretz Yisrael and forms one of its borders, therefore it partakes of some of the importance of Eretz Yisrael.
And now Tana comes from Turkey and goes down.
Yeah, and it goes down through Iraq, yeah. Yeah. That's what we're talking about. The Ben Yehoyada talks about why we need two different metaphors. He says one idea is as far as practical halacha, not necessarily is the Pros considered the border of Eretz Yisrael, because again, the Babel, when they came to build the Second Beit Hamikdash, and then throughout the time of the Second Beit Hamikdash, they never reached that far. However, so according to that, then you could say it's not really like coming close to a person near the oil, where you get some of the oil on yourself, because it's not part of the area, it's not near the area of Eretz Yisrael to which these halachas apply. On the other hand, given that it is part of greater Eretz Yisrael, then therefore it is more like a king, it is more like a servant of a king, and so therefore, so that second metaphor tells us that.
You may go back then. Yeah.
When Mashiach comes, then Eretz Yisrael will be even bigger, yeah. The Rebbe once talked about, by the way, in a sicha, the idea that oil represents mitzvahs, the medrash that mentions that what the others accomplished is like good aromas, like good fragrances, but we accomplish actual mitzvahs like flowing oil. So therefore, order the metaphor of oil over here represents the fact that Eretz Yisrael is a place where actual mitzvahs are performed.
Olive oil.
Yeah, olive oil is on that. And therefore, that's in the house for us, again, has some of the importance of that.
The very fact that
mitzvahs can only be done in Eretz Yisrael, therefore the pros, the Nahar pros, partakes of some of the greatness of that, being adjacent to Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Then we said in the Mishnah, V'achen v'ni alpin kosek, although we said another case of the Mishnah where a person can swear and collect money, was the case of a storekeeper with his notebooks, with his ledgers. We said over there, the case is not, the case is that the storekeeper was told by the balabas at some previous time, I want you to give Pliny X amount of thing, whether it's my worker or my son, whatever it is, and later on the storekeeper claims that I gave it to him, so you need to reimburse me. The other guy says I didn't receive it. And therefore, we said in the Mishnah, both of them end up swearing, the storekeeper and the worker, and they both collect from the balabas. Incidentally, an interesting thing I forgot to mention when we were learning the Mishnah is the Rosh makes the point why we mentioned that he has it in his ledgers. Is the point is, if he remembers it by himself, all the better. But even if he's saying, I myself don't remember one way or the other, but I have written down in my ledgers, I have written down in my notebooks that you told me this, that you told me to give this guy, and I have written down that I actually gave it to him, etc., well, that's also good enough. Anyway. Okay, so Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Omer Rebbe, the Rebbe asks on this, Torach Shvua Zulama, why do we have the Tircha of the Shvua? Why do we have both the storekeeper and the worker come to Beis Din, and inevitably, you're going to have a Shvua Shav over there, you're going to have one or the other, one or the other of them is going to end up swearing falsely. So Rashi explains that Rebbe is not clarifying what he holds. Does he hold like Ben Nanas in our Mishnah, that therefore neither one should have to take a Shavua, or maybe only one of them should have to take a Shavua, because he's arguing, maybe he's agreeing with Ben Nanas, but happy to have that there ends up being a Shavua Shav? Is it that he's holding like Ben Nanas, or is Rebbe saying that maybe what it is the worker should swear and be able to collect, but the storekeeper should have to lose out? Why we shouldn't have the storekeeper reimbursed as well? Rebbe's not clarifying what he's saying. Amalei Reb Chiya, Bar Abba says it here, but that's not really correct because Reb Chiya Bar Abba wasn't in Rebbe's time. So Reb Chiya answers him, Kanena, yes, but we learn already in our Mishnah. We learn Shnei Mishboim Benoitzel and Baal Bais. We learned in our Mishnah that both of them swear and they both end up collecting from the Baal Bais. So that's it. You may have your objections to it. You may wonder, Torach Shavua Zulama, but the fact is you already told us that's how it is in the Mishnah. Well, the question is, Kibla Minei. Did Rebbe accept that and retract his questioning of it or not? You have to realize, by the way. Right, well, that's the question. So you have to realize, of course, even though Rebbe composed the Mishnayos as we have them, there were many Mishnayos that existed before Rebbe, which he himself doesn't necessarily have to agree with. So he's questioning. So we have a Mishnah in our Perek, which, okay, Rebbe himself put the final stamp on the Mishnah, but it's not necessarily something that he himself has to agree with. Right. So in the end, did he retract his question and accept Reb Chiya's opinion based on what the Mishnah says or not? Toshma, Titania, we learn in a Braisa, Rebbe Yomer, Poyel and Mishbor and Lachemini, we learn in a Braisa that Rebbe says that the workers should swear to the storekeeper. They swear they didn't receive anything. So therefore, evidently, what it is Rebbe apparently still sticks to his opinion. He still says the workers are going to swear and going to be entitled to collect that Tachanah Chachamim. The storekeeper is not going to be given the chance to swear and collect from the Balabas. He's going to have to lose out because it's his fault. Why didn't he give to these people the presence of Adim? And if he did, then there wouldn't be any question. The workers are expected to be paid. The workers don't. It's not the workers' responsibility to make sure that they're paid. Yeah. So therefore, it would seem that Rebbe still stuck to his opinion that he disagrees with our Mishnah. Amar Rava, because if you were going to say that Rebbe accepted Rapia's position, which is the position of our Mishnah, then the Balabais Mibarle, then the Braisa, Rebbe should have said that the workers swear to the Balabas that they didn't receive their salary. Well, obviously we're talking there's no Adim. But the fact that it says they swear to the Chenveni implies, therefore, that the Chenveni is the one losing out. Amar Rava, so Rava says, no, that's not necessarily what the Braisa means that Rebbe is saying. Rebbe could mean Poilin Ishbarin, the Balabais Minor Chenveni. What it means is, when the workers swear to the Baal Boss, they have to do it in the presence of the storekeeper. This way, they may be embarrassed of him that, like this, if the worker is going to try to swear falsely, is going to try to claim falsely, I didn't receive it. With the storekeeper being there, he may think twice, because the storekeeper can prove him a liar. Not prove him, but the storekeeper can at least argue that he's a liar, because I did in fact give it to you. So therefore, so that might embarrass him enough into not taking a false shavua. So therefore, therefore, Rebbe might well be agreeing with our Mishnah that both parties swear, the poyel and the chenveni, and they both end up collecting from the balabais. All that Rebbe is adding is a detail which wouldn't have been clear from our Mishnah otherwise, that when the poyel swears, the chenveni has to be present. And actually, the Yerushalmi says that the opposite is also true. When the chenveni swears, the poyel has to be present. Same reason. You don't want the chenveni to be able to swear with impunity that he gave it, and that when without the poyel being there, being available there to possibly contradict it. Yeah. But if both of them stick to their guns and they both make their shavuos, okay, it's true. One or the other of them is going to be a false shavua, but we don't know which one is which. Therefore, the balabas is going to end up paying twice, and that's just how it is.
So
that's it.
The very opposite of what the case that we had before.
No, so we ordinarily say that if there's a shavuos shav, the punishment for the shavuos shav obviously is going to fall on whoever swore falsely. So either the chenveni or the poyel over here is going to. But the difference is like this. Over here, when we have three parties over here, you have to realize, and the Gemara talks about this elsewhere. I mentioned this when we learned the Mishnah. The workers never agreed to do business with the chenveni such that they should have to accept this shavuot, and vice versa. The chenveni never made any deal with the poyelin. They both made their deals with the balabais, with the employer. So therefore, the worker can well say, I'm not obligated to accept the chenveni shavuot. I don't trust him. He claims and he's going to swear that he paid me, but I'm not obligated to trust him. I never told him to do this kind of thing in the first place. The chenveni can say the same thing vice versa. Therefore, yeah, the poor balabas gets stuck in the middle, and therefore, yeah, it does turn out there's a false shavuot over here, but we have no choice. There's no other way to do it.
Well, the balabas chose the chenveni.
That's the point. The balabas chose the chenveni, and therefore he's obligated to accept the chenveni shavuot. He chose the poyel, and therefore, he's obligated to accept the parole shavuot. That's it. Yeah.
In a way, he is. Yeah,
yeah,
you're right.
That's what we're saying. Okay. So that's
in our previous case.
Whereas in the previous case, you only had two parties.
Yeah, two parties.
Yeah. Over here, you have three.
And they were.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, before, as far as the shavuot, by the way, actually Tosfos mentions over here a point that I forgot to mention before, which is, if the shavuot is true, we learned before, when we learned the whole thing, the whole warning that Beis Din gives a person before he swears, we said that one thing is that besides there being a punishment for a person who swears falsely, there's also a punishment for somebody who makes a false claim in order to force the other person to swear. So that's the point. When we said shavuot chol al shneim, one meaning of it is, if he ends up swearing truthfully, the other guy bears responsibility that he falsely accused him. Yeah.
That's what you said previously.
I didn't say it in those words, but yeah, that was the substance of it. Okay. So now a related topic. So since we're talking about this idea of where you have, again, you have both parties, the chenveni and the poyel are both swearing, and they both end up collecting, even though one or the other of them has to be a false shavua, because either the chenveni gave him the goods or he didn't, as the case may be. So now we're going to have a related case. Itmar, we discuss as follows. Suppose you have two sets of edim that contradict each other in Beis Din. Now, we're not talking about edim zomim. Edim zomim, we have a xeris hakasim that you believe the second set. But when it comes to if they're contradicting each other, for example, Rashi says two edim come and say that Reuben killed Shimon, and two other edim came and say Reuben didn't kill Shimon. So we don't know which one to believe. What happens if later on one of these sets of edim wants to give edus in another time? Do we accept them or not? Rav Huna says yes. The one set can come on its own and give edus.
Even though we know
one or the other of them must be lying, but we don't know which one it is. So therefore, the first set is acceptable by a different Eidus. The same way the second set from Tum and Gevedus. Now, what you can't have is you can't mix and match. You can't have one aid from one set and one aid from another set. There's no question that then you're going to have a possible Eidus over there. But to have Reuben and Shimon, Reuben and Shimon, who first came and said that he killed him, and Levi and Yehuda, who say that he didn't kill him, if Reuben and Shimon later on come and give some other aiders, fine, we have no particular basis to possible them.
The suffix.
Yeah. And a suffix is not enough to possible them, right? Yeah. That's Ravuna. Rav Chista, whereas Rav Chista says, no, Badi Sadi Shkori Lomali. What do I need to get involved with Edom who are liars? Given that there's one set of Edom that's possible, neither one of them can be believed for any Edus. Well, we don't know who's lying, basically. In other words, yeah. So therefore, since we know that one of them is possible, so we can't believe either one for any further Edom.
Logical.
Okay. Well, so
but
now.
I mean, what's the eye of the Alaska about pursuing an ed or a group of Edim on which we have suffered?
Okay, so actually, the halacha in this particular case ends up being like Ravuna, actually. Because in general, we say up to the time of Abaya and Rava, we say when a Rav and a Talmud argue, usually the halacha is like the Rav. From the time of Abaya and Rava and on, we have a different rule, but halacha kabasuri, that halacha is like the later authorities, because they're familiar with what the earlier ones said and they still disagree with them. Over here, Ravuna is a chista zeb, therefore the halacha is like Ravuna. So therefore, either set can come and give Eidus by itself. Okay. So now, let's analyze the different...
How can Rav Chista give an opinion opposing each other? It seems...
It's a good question. But it's a good question. But nevertheless, I mean, eventually it was more like a Talmud cover. It was more like a... Okay, it's a good question. But nevertheless, I mean, maybe he only argued it after Ravuna passed away. I don't know. Or maybe... What? But there are halachas as far as this. It could be that Ravuna. It could also be that Ravuna gave him rishus, gave him authority to paskin. Yeah. No, but if your rebbe gives you rishus, then you are. Maybe even. I don't know. Okay. Now let's analyze the different possible scenarios. Shnei malvin or shnei loivin or shnei shtaris. So let's start with suppose that you have the one set of Edim, Reuben and Shimon, are testifying in one loan, and the other set are testifying in a different loan. So you have two different lenders, two different borrowers, and two different shtaris, where, again, you have one shtar is signed by the one set of Edim, and the other one is signed by the other set of Edim. Kind of klotayo. So that would be the case where Rav Huna and Rav Chista are arguing. According to Rav Huna, both shtaris are kosher. According to Rav Chista, both of them are possible. What about Malva Loiva with Shnei Shtaris? What about, though, if you have one Malva Loiva, but there are two different Shtaris? So, Avraham has two Shtaris that he lent Yitzchak money at two different times, and one set is signed by Reuben and Shimon, and the other set is signed by Levi and Yehuda. What do we do then? Then we say, Yad Ba'al Ashtar, Ala Tachsayna, then we say both Rav Huna and Rav Chista will agree that, given that inevitably, one of these shtaris has to be possible because one of these sets of Edom is possible. Therefore, what we do is we say that the one who has the shtaris in his possession, meaning the malva, is going to be the one who has the lower hand, meaning he loses out. He can only collect. He can collect with the smaller one, and he ends up losing the bigger one.
The one who has.
Okay, Avraham lent Yitzchak money two times. One time he lent him 100. One time he lent him 200. One shtar is signed by Avraham and signed by Reuben and Shimon. The other shtar is signed by Levi and Yehuda. Where previously Reuben, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda are these two sets of Edom that we're talking about over here. Both Rav Huna and Rav Chista will agree that then we can say, okay, one of these shtaris is kosher, one of them is fossil. We don't know which one is which. So fine, then, Yad Ba'al Ashtar al-Hachsayna, he has one shtar for 100, one shtar for 200. Fine, he can collect with the shtar of 100, because that, Mamonashach, the other guy owes him, but he can't collect with the shtar of the 200. Now, with that said, though, Rishonim talk about that Rambam brings for example. Exactly. Now, the Rambam talks about that. This is talking about if you bring them to Beis Din at the same time. If he brings the shtaris at two separate times, then conceivably he could collect with one and then later on collect with the other one as well. Because then again, it's the same as the same thing as saying that Reuben and Shimon come at one time and Shimon and Levi and Yehuda come at another time. And we said Rav Huna said that's acceptable. And again, the halacha is like Rav Huna. Okay. What about Shnei Malvin Veloiva Echad or Shnei Shtaris? What about a case where it's two different lenders, one borrower, and there's two Shtaris? So Avraham and Yaakov both lent Yitzchak money, And each one has their own shtar. And one shtar is signed by Reuven and Shimon, and the other one is signed by Levi and Yehuda. Well, then, Hainu must miss it. Well, then that would be the scenario of our Mishnah. Where, again, in our Mishnah, even though inevitably we know that one or the other party in our Mishnah is swearing falsely, we have no choice. We nevertheless make the Balabas pay twice, once to the Poyel and once to the Chemini. The same thing over here. Fine. We know that either Avraham's or Yaakov's shtar is no good, but we don't know which one. So therefore they can both collect. The two lenders, one borrower and two shtaris. Yeah.
So why is saying that one of the shtar has to be contradicting the other?
No, it's not that one shtar contradicts the other, but we know that one of these sets of Edim is no good, right? Because one set of these Edim previously testified that Pliny killed Pliny, and the other one contradicted them and said Pliny didn't kill Pliny. And therefore we know at this point, we know from now on, one of these sets of Edim is liars, but we don't know which one is what. So what we're going to have is the same way as in our Mishnah, both the Chenveni swears and collects from the Balabas, and the Poyel swears and collects from the Balabas, even though it can't possibly be that they're both telling the truth. The same way over here. Avraham is going to be able to collect with his shtar. Yaakov is going to be able to collect with his shtar, even though one of the sets of Edom on one of these shtaris is possible, because we don't know which one is which. And that's it. That's it. What about another case?
We know one of the sets of Edom is false,
but we don't know which one, right? What about Beis Loivin Malva Echad or Shnei Shtaris Mai? What about the other way around? You have Avraham lent to Yitzchak and to Yaakov, each one with their own shtar. What do we say then? So what would Rav Huna say on that? So Rav Chisda, of course would say that no good, that he can only collect with one of them.
Right.
But what would Rav Huna say? Rav Huna is, on the one hand, you have one malva bringing both these shtaris. So again, one of these shtaris inevitably must be possible. So therefore, he's going to end up losing out. Or maybe not. Maybe
it's one set of Edom.
Right. But again, over here, the difference is you have two different loivins. In the previous case, we talked about a case where it's only one malva and one loiva and just two different shtaris. Then we said he can collect with only one of them. Here, with two different loivin, would we say that we treat each one as a separate thing or not, according to Rav Huna? And the answer is teiku. We don't know, and therefore I'm oitzma chaver lo varaya. Now that we had that whole discussion, most of Rav Huna bar Yehuda. So Rav Huna bar Yehuda asks a contradiction as follows. So you're telling me, Rav Chisda, you, Rav Chisda, are telling me that when you have two sets of Edim that contradict each other, and therefore we know that one of them is lying, then both of them are puzzle until we find out the facts. Well, we learn in the Sefer Rosh Hashanah, when it comes to Edim coming for Edus HaChodesh to testify that they saw the new moon, so basically can declare Rosh Chodesh, so suppose you have one aid of a pair of aidens says that the moon was two Mardeyas high. Mardeya means that Mardeya is an ox goad. It's a long stick with a metal tip that they would use to nudge the ox to keep on going in the right direction. So people in those days were farmers, so they'd use an ox goad as a measurement of height. It would be like nowadays you might say how many stories high or whatever. So one of them says it was two Mardeyas high. The Echadem is Sholish, and the other one says, I don't know. It probably depends. Mardeya is a few feet long, I guess. I don't know, but it depends how far away you're holding it from yourself. I don't know. People would use it as a measurement of as an estimate of distance. Like, again, it would be like nowadays. You'd say, you know, I saw the moon one story off the two stories off the ground, and the other one says I saw it three stories off the ground. Same idea. You don't expect common people to talk in terms of degrees, you know. Okay. Anyway, so then Edus and Kayemeth, that's a valid Edus, because we can say, okay, it's somewhere between two and three. No, it's obviously somewhere between two and three, and they estimated, and their estimate was slightly off. That's fine. But we said that if one aid of the pair says it was three off the ground, three Mardeus off the ground, and the other one says it was five, then Edus and Kayla, their Edus is bottle. Three and five is too far apart for us. It's too far apart to reconcile it. So therefore, we had a similar thing in Sanhedrin, by the way, as far as when we have one aid said that it happened during the second hour and the other one during the third hour, versus one said the third and fifth. It's a similar idea. In other words, when one says it was three Mardeus high and the other one five, that's too much of a gap for us to be able to reconcile it. So Edus and Kayla, however, the key thing is, and with Starfin La Edus Acheres, the key thing is, though, the Braita says over there, they can combine for a different Edus. So what does that mean? That seems like not like their sister. My lab la Aedis Mammon. Lahoda, that means that they are acceptable for Aedis Mammon in the future. Each one of these Aedim, even though we know one or the other of them was not telling the truth, because either it was three or it was five, it can't, but well, again,
it made a mistake.
But that big a mistake you're not going to make. So evidently, one of them was telling something untrue, and nevertheless, we're still saying that we can combine them. We can still accept them for other Aedis, for Aedis Mammon. Amar Rava, so Rava says, no, that's not necessarily what it means. It means Huva Acham, it starts from the Aedis Acheres from Rosh Chodesh. It means like this. If you have, let's say, Reuven and Shimon coming to Beit Din, so give Aedis Acheres. And Reuven says that it was three Margeus off the ground, and Shimon says that it was five. So we say we throw out the Aedis. However, we're saying, if later on Reuven finds somebody who says that it was two, then he can combine with him, because two and three are close enough. So if
you can never testify.
No. We're not. In other words, we're not necessarily, according to Rav Chisda, we would say we're not necessarily saying that that these Aedim are able to in the that both the what we're saying is like this. We're saying like this. Reuven will find another person who evaluated the moon as being two or three Margeus off the ground, and he will combine with him. They too will make a valid Aedis Achodesh. And fine, Shimon will say, therefore, is disqualified for the future because there's nobody who claimed to see it as high as five. That doesn't mean necessarily that we would say that both Reuven and Shimon should be kosher by Aedis Achodesh. That's not what it means, according to Rav Chisda. Anyway, it means that one or the other of these was telling the truth. Therefore, if he can find somebody else who agrees with him within a range of one margea, then fine, he'll be an acceptable Aedis. That doesn't say anything about the position of the other one. So that would fit nicely with what Rakrista is saying.
To a certain extent, yeah. They should both be...
No, they can't both be disqualified because... No. Because there you have only one aide said one and one aide said the other. So if one of those aides finds somebody else who agrees with him, who also evaluated the moon as being three Margeus five or two or four, because you have a little leeway of one. If they both find, then fine. Basin is going to then Basin has one set of Aedim that said it was three, another set of Aedim that said it was five. Fine. So then okay, they'll have to figure out astronomically. Well, what was it? Was it three or was it five?
And what do they do with Aedim?
So, okay, so then we would say so. According to Rav Chisda, we would say the same thing. That's one of the well. Then no. Ultimately, we would know the difference is over here when one set of Aedim comes and says that Pliny killed Pliny, and the other one says he didn't. We're talking about we never are able to find out the situation. We're never able to find out what the truth is. There, they're able to find it out. Ultimately, they can look in their calculations and see, well, was it three or was it five? Okay. Amar Rava. So Rava says in this connection. So that Braisa is not a contradiction to Rav Chisda. That Braisa is not saying that both of them are kosher for other Aedis. It means that one of them, whichever one, finds himself somebody to agree with him, will be kosher for Aedis Achodesh. The other one, yeah, will be disqualified.
So there's half truth and half not.
If you want to say it that way, fine. Okay. All right. Amar Rava. The reason why it works, to have a little trevachad, because then what you have is you have two Aedim saying that it was three high, let's say, and you have one Aed saying that it was five high. Fine. But in the Rosh Halacha, Makom Shnayim, you ignore the one in favor of the two, and therefore we establish that it was three. That it was three Margeus high. That's not the same. That's not the same as a case we have two different sets of Aedim contradicting each other, and we can never find out what the truth is. Okay.
Everything or nothing here.
Right. Over here, yeah. Okay, the bottom line is, anyway, the halacha is like Ravuna. The halacha is like Ravuna, that either set of Aedim can come by themselves, or it is we can't take Reuven and Levi and testify together, or Shimon and Yehuda, because I'm sure one member of the pair is from a pair of Aedim.
But
we can take one whole pair. We can take Reuven and Shimon together, we can take Levi and Yehuda together, right? Okay. All right. Then we
said, we had a case in the Mishnah where a person says to a storekeeper,
give me a dinner's worth of fruit, and afterwards they're arguing about whether he paid him the dinner or not. So we had two different scenarios in the Mishnah. We had one where the storekeeper says, give me the dinner, and the balabas says, I already gave it to you, and you put it in your money box. Then we said the balabas swears that he gave him the dinner. On the other hand, we said if it's the other way around, where the dinner apparently was already given, and the balabas says to give me the fruit, and the storekeeper says I already gave it to you and you brought it home, then the storekeeper swears the dinner had not been given yet, rather. So the balabas says where's the payers that I bought? The chenmeni says I already delivered them to your house. So then the chenmeni, that's another case of yeshava v'yitzel, where the chenmeni is able to swear and he's able to collect that dinner.
in the first case?
The first case is that the Balabas is saying that the storekeeper is saying, give me the dinner.
So he claims
that he didn't receive the dinner yet. The Balabas claims I already gave it to you.
So who swears?
So we
said that the Balabas swore passes and he passes from pay.
The Balabas claims that he already gave the dinner, and he's saying, so where is the payers? The Chenveni says, I already delivered them to your house. Then the Chenveni swears, and then he can collect that dinner. Then we have in the Mishnah that Rabbi Yehuda said, it depends who has the payers in their possession. So now back to our Gemara. Tanya, we learn in a braisa. Amar l'chemini ten l'medina peres. Chol Tanya, Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Aim aside. When does this apply that we say that the Balabas has to swear? Bizman shaperes zvurur munochin. When the peres are piled up there and then lying over there. Ushnei and Oyer in Alein, and both of them are arguing about it, whether it was paid for or not. But the peres are piled over there, and both parties are arguing. But if the Balabas already took the payers and put them into his bag, or box or whatever behind his back, then we would say that you want to take it away from him. Then you storekeeper would have to bring a proof. That's not the case where we say that the Balabas would have to swear. Now,
so it's before
the payers are in the
taken.
Right. So now we have. I mentioned the other day. That the shach in connection with these dinim in Choshen Mishpat brings no less than five different explanations of Rishonim what exactly the scenario is over here and finds fault with all of them. So what do we have? Rashi understands the scenario is over here that the payers are already in the Balabas' possession. The dinner is also still in the Balabas' hand. So why is Rabbi Yehuda saying in the Mishnah Kol Shapedus B'Yada Yada Al Yona? And why is he saying that in the first case the Balabas is able to take the payers without any further shvura? Is because usually a storekeeper doesn't usually sell on credit. He usually first receives the dinner. So now our Braisa and our Gemara over here is saying, therefore, that when the payers are piled up over there, that is the case where the Balabas has to swear, because the payers are not any closer to him than the storekeeper, as opposed to if they're already in his possession, we won't assume that the storekeeper would have given it to him without receiving payment, and therefore we have a stronger reason to think that he already paid for it.
So who are we going to make swear?
Therefore, so that's the thing. Then we say, Moitzim HaChavel HaBarai. You storekeeper want to collect your dinner, you're going to have to bring proof that the Balabas didn't pay. But that's not the case where our Mishnah said the Balabas is going to swear, and be poter would be the case where the payers are just piled up over there.
Who's rishus?
Apparently, not necessarily in either one's rishus.
They're
just piled up over there. He doesn't specify where exactly they're piled up.
Either in the Balabas.
No, because they could also be in Rishus Rabbah. They could also be in Rosh Hashanah. Hold on. Some of the other explanations say just that. In fact, some of the Rishonim have a girsa in our Gemara. When we say Tzvurim Menachim, Bir Rosh Hashanah, some of the Rishonim have a girsa, Bir Rosh Hashanah. So, yeah. Okay, so that's Rashi's explanation. But again, the Shach's problem with that is a couple of problems, among other things. What Rabbi Yehuda mentions the concept later on in the Mishnah that a money changer doesn't usually give change on credit. Why doesn't he mention the same point in the first part of the Mishnah? Why is he using a different expression? Kol shaperes biyadei. So you have a problem with that. You have the explanation of the Rif and the Rambam and a number of other Rishonim. Which is that the situation that we're talking about over here is that the payers are piled up in Rishus Rabim. The payers are piled up in Rishus Rabim. So one case is you have one case where the storekeeper agrees that he put them in Rishus Rabim for you, for this lekeach, you bought them. I just say you didn't give me the money yet. So therefore that's when the Balabas would swear and be potter. Because the storekeeper is trying to take away.
You would have taken them, put them in Rishus Rabim without getting paid.
Because if it's in one or the other, if it's in the Rishus of one or the other of them, then why are we saying then we should just depend who's Rishus it's in, and why does Rabbi Yehuda have to point out that point? So therefore, that's why so the Rambam and a couple of other Rishonim understand it that way, that we're talking about, again, our Braisa that said, so again, they have a Girsa, Rishos Rab. So therefore, it literally is piled up in Rishos Rabim. But you have one scenario where the Chenmini says, yes, I did put it in the Rishos Rabim waiting for you, but you haven't paid me yet. Versus the other case where the Chenmini doesn't even agree that I put them for you. I have them out in Rishos Rabim, but I wasn't putting them waiting for you. I was putting them out because I was putting them out there to keep them fresh or whatever. Yes. That's a second explanation. But the Shach brings his own question and questions from a Rav Shlomo Kohen, who have a bunch of questions on this. First of all, I mean, among other things, the expression the Mishnah did not done low implies that he already gave him the pay. That's not that they're piled up in Rishos Rabim. So you have the Shach brings a number of other explanations from the Rishonim, and again he finds fault with each one of them.
So which version are we going to?
So take? Well, so I'm just telling you. So the Shach ends up saying that what it is so you have the case where he definitely gave the payrus to the Balabas. They're already in his bag. But for example, the Balabas argues now. Then the Shach explains why. For example, why does he says among other things? Why does the Mishnah mention that the Balabas says not only I gave you the money, but you put it in your money box? Why is it important to mention that detail that you put it in your money box? The point is, the Balabas argues you were so busy measuring out the payrus for me into my container, therefore you didn't realize when I gave you the dinner, and therefore you think I didn't give it to you. In other words, the Shach explains at some length over here that what we're dealing with over here is a tainus shema. That the storekeeper itself may or may not be sure whether he received the dinner or not. And he goes on and says at some length in that vein. But yeah, I mentioned the other day when we learned the Mishnah that the Shach says at the end that I'm sure when I come to the Olam Emes that he says that the Bali Mishnah and Braisa and the Gemara are all going to come out and greet me that I explained so clearly what they're saying. And then the Taz of course comes in and then gives a whole long explanation and then says you don't have to don't go slogging up everybody else's explanations. Your explanation isn't necessarily any better than theirs, etc.
They lived not far apart.
The Shach and the Taz lived. Well, they both lived in the same general area. They both lived in Poland, Lithuania, or whatever. The Shach afterwards ended up in Moravia, which is nowadays in the Czech Republic. But they were contemporaries. They were contemporaries. The Shach was much younger. The 1600s. The Shach was much younger than the Taz. But they originally published their Svarim when they published their commentaries on Yerideya. They published them almost at the same time. Later on, Choshen Mishpat. The Taz wrote his commentary after the question.
The Taz is
Reb David Segal, Reb David Alevi, and then the Shach is Reb Shabtai Akoyim. The Shach actually mentions, by the way, in his introduction to his commentary on Yerideya, he says, despite the fact that you're constantly seeing that I'm arguing with the Shach, with the Taz, and I wrote a whole sefer Nekudas HaKesef to disprove him, etc., don't think we have anything personal against each other. And he explains that, no, this is the Tachi Dakar Hilterda, that one builds up and the other one tears down, etc. But he describes that, for example, he says, one time the Taz visited me and we had great covered for each other. Okay, getting back to the Gemara.
They live in different
places. The Taz was a Rav in several different cities. The Shach was also a Rav in several different cities. People traveled around in those days. People didn't usually stay put in a Rabbanus for life. And especially both of them had to flee during Zeres Tachlipat. That's how the Shach ended up in Moravia and the Taz also. Yeah. All right. We said in the Mishnah, "Amal Shulchani Ten Lichula." Then we had another case in the Mishnah involving a money changer, where you ask the money changer for change. You ask him for a dinner's worth of change, and afterwards there's an argument between the Balabas and the Shulchani whether the dinner was actually given or not. So again, we had a similar scenario and a similar machlokas between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda about what we do. So why do we need both? Why do we need the case of a storekeeper with payrus and the case of a money changer with money? It amounts to the same thing. So with tzricha, we need both of them. Iyashmin and ha'kamaisa, because if we were only told the case involving fruit, You would say b'hach ka'amri rabbanon. You would say that that's what, in that specific case, the rabbanon say that the balabos will have to swear in the first case, and the chenveni will have to swear in the second case. Mishum de peiri avidi de malkavi, because fruit spoils quickly. Given to Malkavi like Mashulay, and since they spoil quickly, he doesn't want to keep it around. So therefore, we maybe have more, even though we said, again, according to Rashi, that a storekeeper doesn't usually sell on credit. But on the other hand, when it comes to fruit, maybe he might be more willing to sell on credit because he wants to have it out of his possession before it spoils. But when it comes to money, which doesn't spoil, maybe they would agree with Rabbi Yehuda. That depends who has possession of the money of the small change right now. The Itma Baha, and if we only have the second case of the money changer, then you would say Baha Kamar Rabbi Yehuda. Only there does Rabbi Yehuda say what he says, that whichever one has the payers of the Moritz is Yodah Allah Yona. Ava Bahach, but in the case of the fruit, Ema Modulahula Rabbanon, maybe you would agree with the Rabbanon again for the same reason, because a Chenveni might be faster to sell off his stock of fruit because he wants to get rid of it before it's spoiled. Tzricha, and therefore we need both cases to say that the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda in fact disagree on both cases.
Because if we had one case,
but if you had one, you would think that they don't argue. You would think that they don't argue on the other one. Yeah. Okay. Then we said in the Mishnah, the same for Amru Akademis Subas of Achola. We said in the Mishnah that just as when a woman says that she was already paid part of her ksuba. So we say that if she wants to collect the rest of it, she has to swear. And we had a number of other cases where you have to swear in order to collect the drabbanon. The same thing we said, v'chein ha'yisomim lo yiporu. We said the same way, yisomim cannot collect a debt without a shavua. So now we have to ask, which we had part of this discussion in the Gemara yesterday when we were dealing with the question of what it means chaz v'shavua l'makayma. So now we're going to revisit that in greater detail. First of all, we have to ask mimam. Who are we talking about that these yisomim are trying to collect from? Are we talking about that they're trying to collect the debt from the loiva himself? So Reuven had lent money to Shimon, then he died, and now Reuven's children are trying to collect that debt from Shimon. Why should they have to swear? Avu and Shokel below Shavua. Their father, Reuven himself, was still alive. He could have collected without a Shavua because he has a shtar. The Inu Shavua. Why should they have to swear if they also have a shtar in their possession? Why should they be worse off than their father?
They cannot have a shtar, otherwise they won't have to swear.
That's the question. No, we're saying even when they have a shtar. So the answer is hachakama. What we mean is v'chein ha'yisomim min ha'yisomim. What we mean is if both sides, the malva and the loiva, are both being taken over by their heirs. So Reuven's children are trying to collect from Shimon's children. Then lo yiparu ela b'shvur. That is what the Mishnah is saying, that they can only collect with a shvur.
Even when there's a shtar.
Yeah. So now, what is the exact scenario? Rav or Shmuel Dami Tavayu. So again, we learned this also yesterday, that Rav and Shmuel both say that it depends what order they died in. Loishanu Elashemes Malva B'chaya Loiva. This only applies, this was saying that the Yisoyimim can only collect from the other Yisoyimim with a Shmur, only applies if the Malva died while the Loiva was alive. So Reuven died and Shimon was still alive.
Never mind the shtar.
The point is Reuven died, Shimon is still alive.
Right.
So therefore, what happens is the point is Reuven's children at this point are the Malva's children. Reuven's children are owed the debt at this point. They're not obligated to swear because Shimon himself is still alive. When Shimon dies, then a new responsibility for Shavuot, because why should they be? They're collecting from Shimon himself. We just said, the logic is, Reuven himself wasn't obligated to swear. His children shouldn't be obligated either, when they're collecting from Shimon personally. So what happens is, therefore, so now, later on, when Shimon dies, a new responsibility for Shavuot is being created. Very well, they can swear that Shavuot. And the shavua is that the debt wasn't paid off yet. That our father didn't tell us that it was paid off. That we don't have a shaver, that it was paid off, etc. Avol mes loiva b'chayim malva. But Rav and Shmuel say if it was the other way around, if Shimon died the loiva while Reuben the malva was alive, then that's different because kvar nischayev malva lebnei loiva shavua. Because what happens then? Reuben himself, if he wants to collect from Shimon's heirs, has to take a shavua, because we have a general takanas chachamim, as we said in the Mishnah, that any time you're collecting from Yisomim, you need to swear a shavua. So now, in other words, he's not in position right now, Reuben himself is not in position to be collecting that actual money itself without a shavua. It depends on him taking that shavua. And another motor, shavua labanam. However, a person cannot bequeath a shavua, meaning motor, that is to say money that has money that to, which has a shavua attached to it, to his children. So his children are not going to be able to take that shavua to be able to collect from Shimon's heirs.
The children of the Malbit.
The children of the Malbit, Reuben's children, are not going to be able to swear that shavua and collect from Shimon's children. So that's it. Therefore, they're stuck.
No children can take from a by a shavua.
No. We're saying that if Reuben, the Malbit's children, were trying to collect from Shimon himself, they would not need a shavua at all.
Right.
If they're collecting from Shimon's children, then we're saying a shavua is needed. However, what Rav and Shmuel are saying is they can only take that shavua if it's a newly created shavua that came into existence after their father died. But if it's a shavua that their father would have had to swear as well in order to collect from Shimon's children, they can't yarshin that shavua and take it. So therefore, that's it. They're stuck. They can't collect. Okay, Shachua Kameh to Rabbi Elazar. So now they sent this question to Rabbi Elazar, and the question was this question about what are we doing? This did. The question is Shavua Zu Matiba. Why does the Shavua have such strength? Fine, they can't swear the actual Shavua that their father would have sworn, but they can still swear the Shavua that our Mishnah mentioned that our father never told us anything about it, etc. Why shouldn't they be able to swear that Shavua? Why are we saying that? Why are we even denying them that? And therefore, they can't collect at all.
Well, that's not proof of the fact that he never told them.
They swear three things. We said in our Mishnah, they have a shtar after all, right? They have a shtar. And they swear three things: that our father didn't tell us on his deathbed, that he didn't tell us at any previous time, and we didn't find among his papers any indication that this shtar is paid off.
Right.
So they're sending a message to Rabbi Elazar asking the question. So why are we saying that this shavua? Why are we saying that because they can't swear the same shavua as their father, therefore their money is forfeit?
They don't have the shtar. It's their father's shtar.
They yarshin it from their father. They yarshin it from Reuben. Come on. I mean, once Reuben is, he didn't take the shtar to his grave. Obviously, they didn't bury the shtar with him, right?
The shtar is,
yeah,
the shtar
was, yeah, right,
right, so it's not the same.
No. We're not talking about that. Then we wouldn't be talking about Yisraelim. Then that's their own property.
Right.
No, of course we're talking about the shtar was written under Reuben's name.
Right.
But the question is, given, fine, we understand they can't swear the same shavua as Reuben himself would, because they can't know for sure, but they should at least be able to swear the shavua shalet kodanu abba, etc., and be able to collect on that basis. Why are we making mativa? Why is this shavua so strong that because they can't swear, the mativa literally means what strength? Why is that shavua that their father should have taken so strong that once he can't swear it anymore, then we throw out the whole case and prevent them from collecting the debt that was owed to their father? Shalach Lahu, so Rabbi Elazar answers, that was the question. So Rabbi Elazar answers back to them. He sends them back a message. As a matter of fact, yes, Yoshin Nishpoin Shavuos Yoshin in Iceland. Yes, as a matter of fact, I do disagree with Rav and Shmuel on that. The Yoshim of Reuben will, in all cases, be able to swear the Shavuos Yoshin, the Shavuos that our father never told us, etc., but in Iceland, and they'll be able to collect. Okay. Later on, Shachur be made of Ami. Later on, they sent
so
the
that
same.
Is
so we have, that's Rabbi Elazar. So Rabbi Elazar is disagreeing with Rav and Shmuel.
Right.
Okay. Shachur be made of Ami. Later on, they resent this question about Shavua Zumativa, the same question they asked before. They sent that question again in the times of Rav Ami.
You cannot ask twice the same question.
They asked the same question in the times of Rav Ami. They asked the same question. Why are Rav and Shmuel saying that the Shavua is so powerful? Omar, so Rabbi Ami says, why are you even bothering to ask? Kulahai Shakilav Ozli. How many do they have to keep on sending the same question? You already have an answer from Rabbi Elazar. Iyashkechinen Bataima, don't you think if we had found reason to disprove what Rabbi Elazar says and to accept Rab and Shmuel's opinion, if we had found reason to change that opinion, Mila Shakilav Lahu, wouldn't we have already sent out a notification to that effect? The fact that you didn't, you can assume that Rabbi Elazar's fact is still in effect. However, Ella Omer Rav Ami, but Rav Ami says,
Rav Ami,
you know,
was
Rav Ami was the Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael after the time
of
Rav Shurda Gaon explains in his Igeres that you had Rav Yochanan was the Rosh Hashiva, and it was the head Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael for many years.
Right.
Rav Shurda Gaon, actually, the printed editions of Rav Shurda Gaon say 80, some people say maybe it was 60, whatever. Anyway, a very, very long time. Later on, after he passed away, Rav Elazar took over, but Rav Elazar passed away only a few months later.
Mm-hmm.
So then Rav Ami took over. Yeah. So
he's the one who's saying why you are.
So why ask him again? If you don't think if we found reason to overturn it, we would have. But Ella Amar Abami, but Abami says, you know what? You know what? Since this matter has been brought to our attention, name of a milta. However, we will say a detail on this. It depends, really. Let's try to make a compromise, maybe, between Rav and Shmuel on the one hand and Rav Elazar on the other hand. Rav and Shmuel saying that there's a certain case, again, with
his previous statement.
Yeah, okay. But he's saying that the fact is. Now, the fact
why
is.
Are you asking
why
are
you asking? But you know what? Now that we asked, I'm thinking further. Okay, I'm rethinking about it. I have a new idea to say about it.
Okay.
It depends. Omad Bedinu Meh. If they already went to Beis Din, and if they already went to Beis Din, and then Shimon passed away. No, because again, what was Rav and Shmuel's scenario? That we said that if Shimon passed away while Reuven was alive, then we said that Reuven can't be murdered to Shavua. What?
Initially we said
no. We had two different cases. If the Malved Reuven died b'chaya loiva, then we said the Yisomim are collecting from the Yisomim, then they can do it with a Shavua. They can take the Shavua because there's a new Shavua created, Shalot Kodanu Abba. But Rav and Shmuel are saying that if it's the other way around, you can't substitute the father's Shavua, which he would have had to take. You can't substitute that with the son's Shavua, Shalot Kodanu Abba. Therefore, that's it. They're stuck. But now Rav Ami is saying it really depends. If they already went to Beis Din, If Reuven brought out the shtar Shimon passed away, and then Reuven took Shimon's heirs to Beis Din, and Beis Din told Reuven, fine, you're still alive, you're going to be collecting from your Simon, you go ahead and swear, and then you can collect. If that happened, Kvanis Chayev Malva Livnei Loiva Shavua. Well, then it's true already. Then the Malva is obligated of Shavua to the children of the Loiva, to the children of Shimon. And as we said before, the Ainon Amoda Shavua Levonov. And we said before, like Rav and Shmuel said, you can't bequeath the Shavua. So therefore, that's it. Nothing happened. On the other hand, Loi Omad Bedin Umes. But if Reuven had not ever even brought the Shtar to Beis Din against Shimon's heirs before he died, then that's a different thing. Then we would say there was no obligation of a shavuah yet. Therefore, Yoshin Nishvah and Shavuah Yoshin Renaitzlan. Therefore, Reuven's heirs will now be able to swear their new shavuah, Shalot Kodanu Abba, etc., and they'll be able to collect. So this is sort of halfway between Rav and Shmuel's versus Rav Elazar's position. Rav and Shmuel would say that no matter what, if Shimon died first, then when Reuven dies, his children are stuck. Rav Elazar says it doesn't matter regardless. They can always swear their Shavuot Yoshin and collect. Rav Ami is saying it depends. Did they go to Beis Din first or not? Did the obligation with the Shavuot, the obligation of the Shavuot only kicks in when they go to Beis Din, says Rav Ami. Therefore, if they already went to Beis Din, Reuven already was obligated to swear his Shavuot. Now you're trying to replace that with the Yoshin's Shavuot when Reuven dies. You can't do that, as Rav and Shmuel say. But if they never went to Beis Din yet, Reuven was not even obligated to Shavuot yet. Therefore, we're fine. We can have a new Shavua, a newly created Shavua, the Shavua Sayoshin, and they can collect.
If they went to Beis Din before...
Before Reuven died, after Shimon died, but before Reuven died, then we would say, like Rav and Shmuel, that they cannot collect.
They cannot.
They can be Yoshim later on. Reuven Yoshim cannot collect.
Yes.
If Reuven was in a position where he had to swear, then we can't say instead of him swearing his own Shavua that his children are going to swear Shavua Sayoshi, says Rav Ami. That doesn't work. But if Reuven himself was never yet in a position to swear, because they never even went to Beis Din, fine, Reuven's Shavua is out of the picture. Instead, his Yoshim will take their Shavua Sayoshim, and that's it. Then they can collect, like Rav Elazar said. So it's in between, yeah. However, Rav Nachman asks on that, the fact of the matter is it based in that creates the obligation for the Shavua? Me'idna d'shochiv loiva, as soon as Shimon, the loiva, dies, ichayiv le'malva l'bnei loiva Shavua. At that point, anytime Reuven wants to collect, he's going to have to take a Shavua. It's not like it's true, only when they go to Beis Din is that chiyuv created. Elo, Amar Rav Nachman, so no, Rav Nachman says, there's no compromises. The Issa l'drav u'd'shmur Issa, if we're going to accept Rav and Shmuel's position, that because you can't bequeath a shavua to your children, then fine, Issa, then it is, and it applies whether they went to Beis Din previously before Reuven died or not.
So he
left a letter. denies what Rabbani says, right. If you're going to accept Rab and Shmuel, then fine, then you accept it across the board. Elessa, Lessa, and if you can't accept it, then you don't accept it at all. So either you're accepting Rab and Shmuel, or you're accepting Rabbi Elazar. There's nothing in between.
There's no Rabbani.
No Rabbani. So the question is, Alma Mesaf Galay. So you're telling me Rab Nachman himself is not sure what the din should be? Well, Amr Rab Yosef Aman Yumi, what we learned yesterday. Because we said, if we accept Rab and Shmuel's position, then we accept it. If not, then not. Implying he himself isn't sure which position we should accept. But all he says is fine. Rab Ami's position we're definitely rejecting, but we don't know whether we should accept Rab and Shmuel or Rab Elazar. But we find, we said yesterday, and we said on Mem Zayin, that Rab Yosef Aman Yumi reported that Ovid Rab Nachman Uvda Yachloiku, that we said that Rab Nachman passed in an actual case when both of them were choshur, where neither one was able to swear, which is similar to our case over here, because neither side can swear. And Rab Nachman said over there, Yachloiku, that you divide it. So that's a contradiction. What do you mean? That he's not sure whether that he's not sure whether they should be able to collect or they should not be able to collect. He himself had a position that they divide it. The answer is Ledvar of their Meir Kalmar. Rab Nachman is only saying that. He's reflecting Rab Meir's opinion. The Leilai Svirlai, he himself doesn't agree with it. There's a different girsa that brings over here on the side that not Rab Meir, but Rab Ami. The Rab Nachman is saying, if we go according to Rab Ami, what we would actually have to say is that Yachloik. Instead of Rab Ami's compromise, that it depends whether they went to Beis Din or not, Rab Nachman says, what Rab Ami should have said is Yachloik. I myself disagree with that whole premise of compromises, and therefore I say it's either one or the other.
But that's what he should have said.
But that's according to the Girsa of Ami. According to the Girsa of Meir, it means that Rab Nachman is using that to explain what would Rab Meir say in our Mishnah, but he himself doesn't necessarily hold that.
The bottom line is,
and so we don't know yet. We have Rab and Shmuel's opinion. We have Rab Elazar's opinion. We don't know yet. Most of Rab Oshia. So now Rab Oshia asks a contradiction on this. You're telling me Rab and Shmuel that you can't bequeath a shvur, that if you have money which depends on a shvur, you can't collect it because when the Yoshim rather that is can't collect it when you're going to have a new shvur replacing an old one. But we learned in Ksuvus. We had a case that. We said over there that an almana, we said, under certain circumstances, can only collect her ksuba for up to 25 years. After 25 years, we talked about over there the cases when she's living together with the yisayimim in the same house, so either after 25 years, inevitably it has to be they've given her enough, a little here, a little there, to pay off her ksuba, or just that if she hasn't asked for it in 25 years and she's moichel. Actually, it's the other way around. If she's not living with them, if she's living in her father's house, then she has 25 years. If she's living with them, then she can collect it even many years later. So she may be embarrassed to ask them for it, whatever. The point
if
is,
she
stays in her father's house, then she has a 25-year deadline.
Statute of limitations.
Yes. And the Mishnah continues over there. Mesa, if she dies during that 25 years, Yosheha Maskirin Ksubah Sadrasim Mokham Ashanim, then her Yoshim are able to mention her Ksubah and collect it. Up to 25 years.
By
a shvur, evidently, yeah. Obviously, they have to take a shvur yoshin that she didn't tell them was paid off, etc. So we see, therefore, that the loiva died during the lifetime of the malva because, effectively, as a husband and wife are concerned, he's the loiva, she's the malva, because he owes her the money. So he died first. She was in a position to collect her ksuba, and later on, her children are able to come after 25, within 25 years, and take a shvur and collect. So you see, you can yash and a shvur, yeah. The answer is, yes, but the case that the Mishnah could be talking about over there is she already swore and then she died. Once she swore, no. Rabbi Ami was talking about they went to Beis Din. He didn't swear yet. They went to Beis Din, and Beis Din said you are obligated to swear. He was talking about she actually swore. Therefore, that's it. And at that point, she could have collected the ksuba. But at that point, she didn't, for whatever reason. Then she died. Who Yoshim now have on the basis of that shvur that she already took while she was alive, that the ksuba wasn't paid off, they have 25 years to collect it.
Okay. So yeah. And in the previous case, they had not sworn.
They had not sworn yet, exactly.
They went to Beis Din,
but they didn't swear yet, right.
And on their way to Beis Din, they passed away?
No. They went to Beis Din. Beis Din said, you are obligated to swear.
Where?
You want to collect from Shimon's children. You got to swear. And before he swore, he died.
He died.
Yeah.
And here
we're talking about she already.
Before he died.
Right. Toshma. Okay, let's bring another proof, also from something we learned in Ksuvos. Another proof against Rav and Shmuel. Another We thought this was. We answered that it's not, because if we once we explain Shinishbo Mesa, then it has nothing to do with their case. But if we assume, we assumed for purposes of the question that she hadn't swore yet. Yeah. Okay, so Tashma. We learn also in Kesubas, Nasa Rishono Me. So a man marries a first wife and she dies, so now he's obligated to pay her Kesuba to her heirs. Nasa Shnio Mesu, Nasa Shnio Mesu. Then he marries a second wife and then he dies first. So now you have two women in line to collect the Kesuba, or two women or their heirs or whatever. Shnia V'yosher, Kaidman the Yosher Rishona. And you say the second wife comes ahead, she or her Yoshim come ahead in collecting the Kesuba. So Rashi brings over here, the case is the Mishnah starts off by talking about a case where he writes in a document, he makes a kinyan or whatever with his first wife that I'm not obligating you or your Yoshim in any shavuos. So therefore, when the first wife dies and her Yoshim come to collect, they're not obligated to take a shavuot. But when he dies, then she still has to take a shavuot to his heirs. So, because he only exempted them from swearing to him, not to his heirs, not to his Yoshim. So the second wife has to take a shavua, she or her Yoshim have to take a shavua to the Yoshim of the husband. Yeah. So again, we see then that you have a case where shavua can be Yoshim, right? The answer is Hochanami Shinishbo Mesa. Here also we're talking about that she swore already and then she died.
So that confirms.
So yeah.
Why do we need two cases?
Because we had two different cases that we were asking from. We thought one we thought is talking about what she swore, the other one we didn't know. Wait, Toshma, our Yoshim must be an oyster, but continues the mission over there. His Yoshim, actually it's a different case over there, where his Yoshim can make her swear when she comes to collect her Ksuba. This is a different case. The Es Yosheha, or her heirs, the Es Aboyin Bereshosa, or anybody who comes on the basis of her claim. So therefore, we see that his Yoshim can make her Yoshim swear. Now, this is something, again, her Yoshim swear. Now, again, anytime a woman collects her Ksuba, from Yisraimim, she's supposed to swear that it wasn't already paid off. And like this, you're making, the Yoshim are making her Yoshim swear, which shows that you can be Kuita Shavua. Amar Shmaya looks blood in Katani. So Shmaya says, the Braitha over there is telling us two different possibilities. Oisa Balmana, it means either they make her swear, if it's Balmana herself, then they can make her swear. V'yosheha v'grusha, what's the case of her heirs, is talking about where she was divorced. So therefore, because once when he divorced her, then there's no shavua is necessary.
Right.
A shavua is only necessary when it is only necessary for an almana to collect.
Right.
So you have, when we say oisa v'es yosheha, we mean there's some cases where it's oisa, namely where it's salmona, but it can't be her yoshim in that case, because it can't be kuita shmura. What's the case? Where it's a grusha, then the point is she herself wouldn't have to swear being a grusha. However, her children, because they're collecting from yoshim, are going to have to swear shuwa the yoshim. Fine, so there are two different cases. So therefore,
children have to swear.
Are going to have to swear if they, yeah, because, again, we're talking about, this is similar to the previous case. And it is a continuation of the previous case where he said to the wife that you are potter from a shavua, however, your yoshim are going to be higher than a shavua. You and your yoshim are going to be potter from a shavua, however, they're only potter from a shavua to me, not to my yoshim. So therefore, again, she's not going to have to swear the grusha, but the children will have to. But again, so we're talking two different scenarios where she has to swear versus where her yoshim has to swear. But they're not doing it by yarshining a shavua from her. They're doing it as a regular shavua to yarshin that she didn't tell us that it was already paid off. So still no contradiction against the davening shavua. Okay, to be continued tomorrow, Beis Hashem. Yeah.